WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Donvan and for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 70 years ago this week, Japan surrendered to Allied forces to end its involvement in World War II. Its mighty Imperial Army was disbanded, and Japan's new constitution, largely influenced by U.S. General Douglas MacArthur, forbade the Japanese from waging war ever again. Now Prime Minister Shinzo Abe is giving Japan's military more muscle and upsetting Japan's neighbors. This hour, On Point, Japan's push to redefine its use of military force. Later in the hour, the incredible story of a top-secret unit that used inflatable tanks and artistry to deceive the Germans during World War II. You can join us on air or online. What do you make of Shinzo Abe's military ambitions? And should Japan reinterpret its pacifist constitution? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. So joining me now to talk about this possibly restive Japan is Sheila Smith from Washington. She is Senior Fellow for Japan Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of the book Intimate Rivals, Japanese Domestic Politics and a Rising China. Sheila Smith, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, John.
It's a pleasure. And also from Washington, Yuki Tatsumi joins us, Senior Associate of the East Asia Program at the Henry L. Stimson Center and co-author of Global Security Watch Japan. Yuki Tatsumi, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me, John.
Yuki, let's talk a little bit about this anniversary that's coming up this Saturday. Is the 70th anniversary of Japan's surrender at the end of World War II. And there's been a lot of discussion about the words that will come out of Prime Minister Abe's mouth on that day, because there's, at least now for 20 years, something of a tradition. I think you know what I'm talking about. Describe what that tradition is or that practice has been and what the discussion is about Abe now.
Sure. So as you pointed out, for the last 20 years, it has been the tradition by the Japanese Prime Minister to issue a statement to commemorate the end of the World War II. And in that statement, it is also a tradition since 1995 that he would confirm or reconfirm and reaffirm Japan's apology for its past wartime behavior. And the key word that are on the debate actively in Japan right now is whether Mr. Abe will exactly repeat those words. And those key words are aggression, apology, and remorse. Mr. Abe has frequently mentioned in the past that although he and his government will completely inherit past statements made by his predecessors, he would also say at the same time that if he issues a statement with his name on it, he would not just want it to be a mere repeat of the past statements. So that generated the great speculation, especially amongst the South Korea and Chinese media, and some in the American media as well, whether he would actually stop using some of those three keywords that I just mentioned in his statement upcoming, anticipated tomorrow.
And Yuki, do we have a signal about which way he's going with that?
We do have some signal. On August 6th, coincidentally with the Memorial Day for the atomic bombing on Hiroshima, his advisory council to consider this very issue submitted the recommendation to the Prime Minister. And this council is chaired by Professor Shinichi Kitaoka, who has a confidence of the Prime Minister. And this group's recommendation is essentially that he should seriously consider including those very key words to accurately reflect the Japan's national consensus on this issue.
Sheila Smith, I want you to explain to our listeners, an American audience, when U.S. presidents apologize for any sort of historical action, and we've heard them, or near apologies at least, from both Bill Clinton when he was in the White House and from Barack Obama since he's been in the White House, they come in for an enormous amount of criticism for apologizing and for acknowledging any sort of wrongdoing. In Japan, is the Japanese position of remorse for World War II and the acknowledgement of aggression, I don't know if the word popular is correct, but is that a popular position or is that a deeply resented position?
That's a great question. I think remorse is probably not a contested word whether you're conservative or liberal in Japan. I think most Japanese, the post-war generations, and now there's three of them that we're talking about, they do feel that remorse is the right way to express the post-war Japanese look at their history in the 20th century and the suffering that they caused to people of Asia. I think the key word here that's more contested is apology. And the Japanese word that has been used by Prime Minister Murayama in 1995 and again by Prime Minister Koizumi, a conservative, in 2005, is owabi. And that is a Japanese sense of regret and a little bit slightly different than our formal English apology word, but it expresses their sincerity in addressing their Asian neighbors. So the question is whether Mr. Abe will use that word, owabi. I think if you look at the media in Japan, you'll see a lot of debate over this, whether Japan needs to continue to apologize. It signed post-war peace treaties with both South Korea in 1965 and in 1978 with China. In both of those treaties, they addressed the past and began a future, a post-war future. So for a lot of Japanese, they feel like continuing to have to apologize and continuing to be pressed to apologize by both China and South Korea is no longer appropriate for Japan.
So it goes both ways. The arguments are going both ways there.
That's right.
Let's go to a sort of seminal moment. Back in 1945, September 2nd was when General Douglas MacArthur, aboard the USS Missouri, formally accepted Japan's surrender at the end of World War II. And in remarks right after the signing of the documents, MacArthur expressed his own wish.
Let us pray that peace be now restored to the world and that God will preserve it always. These proceedings are closed.
Yuki Tatsumi, MacArthur stayed for quite a while in Japan and had enormous influence over the writing of its constitution. Talk to me about the pacifist impulse he had written into that constitution. And I'm also curious, almost to the same question I put to Sheila Smith, how much is that pacifist impulse embraced by the culture?
I think pacifist impulse that you just mentioned, I think very much absorbed by Japanese people's psyche. And especially when we talk about Japanese constitution and whether to reform or reinterpret, the particular clause that always comes into the debate is Article 9. And that is where you can actually see the crystallization of his aspiration for what the post-war Japan might look like. And Article 9 has two sentences. And one first sentence basically says that the Japan will renounce the war as the means to settle international differences. And the second sentence also goes actually a step further and said Japan, this constitution prohibits Japan to own Army, Navy, Air Force, and also renounces the war, the right of a belligerence as a means to be used by as a national power. So in those two sentences, you can very much see what he aspired in the immediate years after the Japanese surrender. However, the Cold War strategic environment didn't really allow him to preserve that ideal. Mm-hmm. He realizes that once the Korean War started, he was aware that a large amount of mobilization of American forces was needed for the Korean Peninsula, which kind of meant that all the American forces that were stationed in Japan need to now be deployed to the Korean Peninsula. And who would preserve the domestic order in Japan turned up as a very key question for General MacArthur. And that's when this movement toward the Japan recreating Japan's professional armed organization to preserve a domestic safety and for homeland defense actually started.
Sheila Smith, I think we need to talk a little bit more as we move forward in this conversation, again, about Prime Minister Abe. And to take up on what Yuki was talking about, references to Japan's neighbors, particularly China and Korea, what do they make of Prime Minister Abe's somewhat more assertive language in relation to Japan's place in history and destiny?
Well, I think this is Prime Minister Abe's second time in office. Mm-hmm. He was prime minister in 2006, 2007 for a year. His ideas are well known. He himself has written about them. He wants to escape from this post-war Japan, this mentality of a post-war Japan, by which he really does mean that he's not so comfortable with this idea of continuing to apologize, but also to have his people see Japan as a country that was defeated in war. So he has a rather vigorous vision of a national identity that he wants to put forward. Part of what he's also very keen on is to look again at the way in which the previous Japanese governments have interpreted Article 9. In 1972, the Japanese cabinet officially interpreted it to prevent the right of collective self-defense. And what that means is that the self-defense force, Japan's military, cannot act in concert with other militaries. They cannot use force on behalf of other militaries. So that, of course, affects the U.S.-Japan alliance considerably. Mr. Abe would like to remove that, and he did that actually last summer. His cabinet announced the decision in a limited fashion to reinterpret that right of collective self-defense. You've had a very strong reaction from both South Korea and China. Remember, too, that there's been a significant period of diplomatic estrangement between Tokyo and those two countries. Mr. Abe did not create those diplomatic issues. He inherited them when he came back into office in December 2012. But on top of that diplomatic estrangement now comes his more invigorated attention to defense reforms in Japan. And so there's been a lot of pushback by both Beijing and Seoul.
This is On Point. I'm John Donvan, and for Tom Ashbrook. And we're talking about Japan's push to reinterpret its pacifist constitution 70 years after its World War II surrender. Sheila Smith is with us. She is Senior Fellow for Japan Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. And Yuki Tatsumi is also with us. She is Senior Associate in the East Asia Program at the Stimson Center. And in April, only a few months back, Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, who is central to this conversation today, gave an address before a joint meeting of Congress. And in the address, he spoke about Japan's move to reinterpret its pacifist constitution.
We are working hard to enhance the legislative foundations of our security. Once in place, Japan will be much more able to provide a seamless response for all levels of crisis.
So, Yuki Tatsumi, I want to circle back to that issue because Sheila Smith touched on this notion of a reinterpretation, really, of, I'm assuming, Article 9, as you referred to before, but what he's really talking about is Japan's military stance in the region and in the globe. So can you get to some of the specifics, some more of the specifics of what Abe is talking about?
Yes. So Mr. Abe, soon after he made that speech in front of the U.S. Congress, his government submitted the package of the legislations to modernize the existing Japan's legal framework to authorize activities for self-defense forces. And the self-defense forces, when it first started in 1954, it was essentially or primarily or almost exclusively, I would say, the Organization for Homeland Defense. And the international operations were not anticipated at all.
And when you say self-defense force, that's actually the name of the military. Not even the military. In the same way we say National Guard, their entire uniformed force is called the self-defense force.
Yes. So they have three branches, just like United States have Army, Navy, Air Force. Mm-hmm. There's a ground and naval and air self-defense forces. So that is the collective name for that organization. So like I said, when the organization first started, they were not anticipated to operate overseas because they were established more like a National Guard purposes for American audiences. But at the end of the Cold War, that changed a little bit environment were more conducive for self-defense forces to go abroad as long as those missions are for disaster relief, humanitarian assistance, like at the end of major disasters in the Asia-Pacific region and beyond, and also for participation in the peacekeeping operation led by United Nations. But even in those cases, their use of arm on the ground were severely restricted. And that is because of the identity that it was born on. It was born with the lessons from the war that Japanese people do not like to see its armed organization like self-defense forces to wage a war or make a resort to aggressive behavior against the people in the other country. So that is why those types of the mission that they were allowed to do outside Japan has been constrained, and also the rules of their activities on the ground is also heavily constrained. What Prime Minister Abe is essentially saying is that sometimes when Japan participates in the those multilateral organization, because their rules of engagements are so restrictive that it cannot work as smoothly as it could with other militaries that are participating in the same peacekeeping operations. Hmm. And also, in the last several years, there were situations where what's commonly referred to in Japan and the U.S. defense planners as a gray zone situation, which is a short of a full military conflict, but still a very assertive show of will by either paramilitary or a similar forces around Japanese territory. And there's a great debate in Japan how to best to respond to that. So what basically, Prime Minister Abe tries to do in this new legislation that he put out, his government put out in front of the Japanese parliament, is that to make sure that self-defense forces has the sufficient legal authorizations to be able to do what it needs to do, essentially, to protect Japanese territory and protect Japanese people abroad. But then let me just emphasize this point again, mm-hmm. that whatever the expansion of self-defense forces that are allowed in the new legislation is very much either directly linked to the Japan's homeland defense or either very closely linked to the safety of Japan's allied forces, namely U.S. forces, and the country military of the country that has Japan has a very close security relationship.
Well, that doesn't, to Shelley Smith, what Yuki just described doesn't strike me as very radical. Why is it so controversial?
Well, it's controversial, John, in two places. It's controversial at home, and I think you've seen this summer, Yuki laid out a very pragmatic policy agenda, and the Abe administration has been very cautious about how fast it wants to move these goalposts on collective self-defense. So, in fact, the prime minister is putting forward a fairly limited notion of when and how the self-defense forces might use force abroad. But the debate this summer in Tokyo, I think, has been very interesting. It has been partly politics. There's been some slip-ups in terms of the management of the conversation by the ruling coalition, Mr. Abe's coalition. But what you're hearing in Japan today, and it's in front of the upper house of parliament at the moment, and these bills will be discussed for the next month or so, you're starting to hear a very deep question about, first of all, is this really reinterpretation of the existing constitution, or is the Abe government really pushing Japan beyond the boundaries of the current constitution? Mm-hmm. So that's one. The second is this question that's always been under the surface in post-war Japan, which is civilians lost control of their military in the pre-war period. In other words, the Imperial Japanese Army and Navy went off. Particularly the army, went off cue in China in particular, and the civilians couldn't rein them in. Mm-hmm. Even the emperor couldn't rein them in. So there's a deep lesson learned here that MacArthur was talking about during the occupation period in the Constitution, but also there's been a reorganization of civilian authority in post-war Japan. And so you hear that resonance in the domestic debate as well. I think if you will, though, we have to place this in regional context. Japan's military has never really had to think about being attacked by another military. If you look back at the 70 years or so since the end of the war and the self-defense forces were created, really it was a support role for the Japanese military in helping U.S. forward deployed troops in case of a contingency on the Korean Peninsula or across the Taiwan Straits. But today, the pressures that Japan is feeling in the region, the nuclearization of North Korea and the proliferation of missile capabilities to potentially deliver that, in addition to the maritime expansion of China, have really put different challenges before Japan's security planners. So you see in this seamless response that Yuki talked about, a focus really on the territorial dispute with China. Mm-hmm. So the last several years or so, from 2010 through 2012-13, you had some very overt pressure from Chinese non-military but paramilitary forces, as Yuki pointed out. And the Japanese were really quite unprepared to figure out how to cope with that, either alone or in concert with the United States. So this is a reform of their crisis management capabilities. Mm-hmm. It's civilian as much as it's military. And I think the Abe administration is feeling that the time has come for Japan not to be aggressive or to move out in the region, but to develop partnerships with others around the Asia-Pacific who are also concerned with this changing regional security environment.
Hmm. But even that seems to be extremely controversial, although to my ears and maybe to many listeners, it doesn't seem like a major step forward. But let's bring in some of our listeners now. Bob is calling from Buffalo. Bob, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John.
Hey, Bob.
I'd just like to make two points. One is that I think it is important to maintain a very pacifist role for Japan in Asia. But I do think that, particularly in regards to those security issues that affect the United States and Korea, that they should bear a much larger cost and pay for those costs. And secondly, in regards to Japanese pacifism, I'd like to point out that there still, as of today, remains a Shinto temple in Japan that has been visited by Abe and other high Japanese officials that pays tribute to convicted war criminals like Hashimoto and Tojo. And I think that's the way we ought to view the Japanese pacifism when you talk about a historical look. They still honor war criminals responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people.
Bob, thanks for your call. And I want to take that a little bit of your point to Yuki Tatsumi, because I've been wondering, is the fact that Abe, now the second time he's prime minister, is he prime minister because of his stance on this issue? Is that his big selling point to the Japanese public?
Actually, when he came back to the government, that was probably the least issue that the Japanese public in mind. Japan, for the previous 3 years before Abe's return to the government, we had the period where we had a different prime minister every year, practically. And the Democratic Party of Japan, who had governed the previous 3 years, very much deeply disappointed Japanese public in terms of the lack of their governing skills and their lack of crisis management skills. And also, Japanese public were very disappointed in the Democratic Party of Japan government of not being able to bring back their economy on track. So public, in essence, elected Abe to be their prime minister again, not because of the security agenda, but with the aspiration that his very strong leadership style, he can finally drag the Japanese economy out of this stagnation and also implement some of the fundamental institutional reform to their economic system that's badly needed.
Interesting. Let's bring in Ed from Fairfield, Connecticut. Ed, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. I simply wanted to say that stasis is not part of the world we live in any longer. Mm-hmm. I remarked when I was being screened that when the towers dropped in New York City, it was enormously comforting that there were German planes, NATO allies, flying along our eastern coast to protect us. Japan has grown in the Pacific to become one of our allies, a weakened, older ally. It seems to me that this idea of stasis, lack of letting go of the past is not helpful in any way. There is clearly a history and a bad history between the Chinese and the Koreans and the Japanese. That's local, but to keep the Japanese trapped inside some of a box, sort of a box that existed ages ago,
right?
Like 52.
Right. It sounds like it sounds as though you're saying that you think that Prime Minister Abe is probably on the right track. Let's bring in Lester from Augusta, Georgia. Lester, welcome to On Point.
I'm Lester Franklin Court. Now, I live in Korea from the U.S. military and make four tours there.
Mm-hmm.
And the people are so terrified about Japan rearming itself. Put it, if they are more terrified than Japan, then they are terrified of North Korea. The people in the China, I got many Asian people, and it's one of the most dangerous things. We could allow Japan to even start rearming themselves.
Lester, let me take your point. I want to take your point to Sheila Smith as she studies this. Sheila, take to Lester's point that actually, you know, China, mighty China, would still be afraid of Japan.
I think just a couple of context points here about the size and scope of Japanese military spending and the Japanese capability. So Japan's military today, the Japanese spend about number seven globally in terms of how much they spend on their military, much higher than you might expect if you talk about Japanese pacifism and some of the political issues we're talking about. But, you know, this is 2013 data, and it was about $51 billion worth of spending on defense. China, same year, $112 billion. So China's catching up. Much more in absolute terms, but China is obviously in a much more ambitious mode of trying to catch up technologically, not only to Japan, but also the United States. So there's some dynamics in the region that we ought to be alert to here. I think
how modern is the again, I don't know if we can use the word military. I suppose we can about Japan.
Yeah, we should.
Yeah. Okay, all right.
Yeah.
That's clear. How modern is its armed force?
The Japanese Navy is the best in Asia. It is second to the United States Pacific Fleet in terms of its capabilities and its performance. Huh. I'm not saying that to scare anyone. I'm just saying that, you know, remember, we're building here on 50 to 60 years of alliance cooperation between the United States and Japan. So the Japanese Navy is deeply integrated in its operational capability and its you know, its role in HADR, as Yuki pointed out. It's a very sophisticated and technologically competent Navy. The Air Force similarly has had to deal with the Soviets in their northern border throughout the Cold War. Japanese pilots are among the best in the world, but they have dedicated themselves, again, to territorial defense. But they are armed with sophisticated weapons that the United States military has developed as well. So Navy and Air Force, very sophisticated. The Japanese Army, again, much more dedicated to that, you know, national territorial defensive role. They have expanded their experience globally through United Nations peacekeeping efforts. They've worked with some of them in the most dangerous regions around the world and some of the most dangerous missions. So the Japanese Army has a very international outlook today in ways that contribute to UN, particularly the UN global role. But to go back to this question about stasis versus be careful what you change here, I think it's an important tension. And I think what I was trying to highlight earlier is we talk about the political debate over the place of the Japanese military in crisis management. And I think there's very few Japanese today who see their military as chomping at the bit and trying to take over Japanese foreign policy or strategic ambitions. What we're really talking about here is loosening the reins somewhat to allow the military to use force in scenarios where they've been severely curtailed in the past. I do think this question of reciprocity is going to come back to the United States and Japan, as Ed pointed out. But right now, we should work with the Japanese in a careful way to make sure that they're prepared to deal with a changing Asia.
Sheila Smith, thanks so much for joining us. You're a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of the book Intimate Rivals, Japanese Domestic Politics in a Rising China. Sheila, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Yuki Tatsumi, senior associate of the East Asia Program at the Henry L. Stimson Center, co-author of Global Security Watch Japan. Yuki Tatsumi, thanks to you as well.
Thanks, Sean.
And when we come back, the story of the Ghost Army, a top secret unit that used deception and artistry to trick the enemy during World War II. I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
This podcast is sponsored by Casper. Casper is an online retailer of premium mattresses made in America. They're engineered for comfort and long-lasting support by combining premium latex foam and memory foam. It's outrageous comfort at a polite price. Here's the great part. Pick the one that is best for you and try it out, risk-free for 100 days, with free delivery and returns. Go to casper.com/onpoint and you can save $50. That's casper.com/onpoint. Now back to the show.
This is On Point. I'm John Donvan in for Tom Ashbrook. And in the summer of 1944, a handpicked group of U.S. soldiers landed in France with a mission to use artistry, creativity, and trickery to fool the enemy. They used inflatable tanks, fake radio transmissions, costumes, impersonation techniques, anything to confuse German troops. These Trojan horsemakers of World War II are known as the Ghost Army. Joining me in the studio is Rick Beyer. He co-authored the new book, The Ghost Army of World War II, with Elizabeth Sales. He also made the documentary, The Ghost Army, in 2013. You can find a gallery of images from the book and an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Rick Beyer, welcome to On Point.
Great to be here, John.
This is an amazing story that you have discovered and made a film about. I've seen the film, and I have seen the book, and interestingly, it's an unknown story largely because it was a secret unit in World War II operating in the European theater whose mission was to do what?
Deception. Their mission was to deceive the enemy through impersonating other real American units. So it's a smaller group of men impersonating large military units and doing it with inflatable tanks and artillery and trucks, doing it with sound effects, doing it with impersonation and literally on the ground impersonating generals, setting up phony headquarters, all these things in order to maybe hide a weak spot in the line where we didn't have enough real fighting troops, or to draw the enemy away from where a real unit was so that they could attack and hopefully do better without the enemy against them.
Where did the name Ghost Army come from?
The name Ghost Army is a sort of an appellation that was assigned to this unit kind of late in the war by some of the men in the unit. And on the cover of their official history, which was classified for 40 years after the war, and it's in the National Archives, is in fact an emblem with a ghost on it. And that is kind of where that comes from. They didn't really call themselves that during the war, but it's kind of got slapped on them at the end of the war.
So how big a unit was this?
This was 1,100 men. Mm-hmm. And it might sound like a lot of men, but these deceptions were carried out on a very large scale. So a typical deception where they're impersonating an armored division of, say, 15,000 people with tanks and all of its equipment might cover 500 square miles. I mean, it might be really a huge area, like 20 miles by 25 miles that they're trying to carry off this deception in.
So the gambit was that they went into the field and tried to convince the Germans that there were a lot more of them than there were, that they were in places that they weren't, that they weren't, and vice versa.
Right. So say that the real 75th Infantry Division is over here to the left, but we want to convince the enemy that they're 10 miles away so that they move all their troops over there. And then when the real 75th attacks, there won't be anybody in front of them. And the thing that's really interesting about this, John, is they're doing this on the battlefield. So it's one thing to like do a deception when you're back in England or something like that, but they're doing this sometimes within half a mile of the front lines. And so imagine being a 19-year-old soldier on the front lines, near the front lines, and your weapons are inflatable tanks or your weapons are sound effects records. That's what they were doing.
Literally sound effects records.
They brought sound effects records into Europe with them, and they would then mix those sounds together to create the kind of sounds that they wanted to use for any particular scenario.
So you actually have some sample of something that they actually would, I guess, broadcast in the middle of the night from these huge sound trucks. Tell me what this sound is.
These are tank sounds, and they would be broadcast from a wire recorder on over a 500-pound speaker that had a range of 15 miles. And, you know, imagine, you know, if you're asleep at night in your house and you hear a sound outside and suddenly you build up in your mind that it's a burglar coming in, well, it's the same thing. They're playing on sort of the theater of the mind, trying to get the enemy to believe that there's a real unit there. And it's a multimedia deception. So it has visual, it has radio, it has sonic, it has all these things working together to convince enemy intelligence.
What's the visual? You mentioned the inflatable tanks.
Right. So you have inflatable tanks.
These are life-size.
Life-size inflatable tanks, hundreds of them. You can set them up, you camouflage them, but you do it a little badly so that parts of them stick through and the enemy can see them, so that enemy reconnaissance might see these inflatable tanks or inflatable artillery, or they even had inflatable airplanes so they could set up kind of phony airfields with inflatable airplanes. All of that stuff for visual reconnaissance from enemy aircraft or from somebody observing in a church tower.
Whose idea was the Ghost Army?
Really came about because of two American staff officers who were kind of a marriage of opposites. One of them was a civilian before the war, Ralph Ingersoll, very well-known journalist and author, a publisher, worked for The New Yorker, for Forbes. He was a very controversial guy, had a reputation as a liar and an exaggerator, kind of a good pedigree for a deception person. And the other one was a very buttoned-down military guy named Billy Harris, who's father was a general, his brother was a general, he eventually became a general. And the two of them were impressed by what the British had done with tactical deception in North Africa. And so you have this, they're trying to say, what can we give to the Americans that they can use on the ground that will be really helpful? And you have this creative tension between the creative guy and the military guy, and out of that comes this mobile multimedia deception unit that really is unlike anything else in the history of war.
If you want to ask Rick Beyer about the Ghost Army, he is the world's expert on this topic at this point. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. As the world's expert, this was a secret unit. So how'd you find out about it?
It was declassified sometime about 20 years ago. I found out about it because my former business partner, Mark Tomizawa, introduced me to somebody whose uncle was in this unit. And I had never heard...
You knew a guy whose uncle was in it.
I knew a guy who knew a gal whose uncle was in it. And that was the connection. And I had never heard the story. I knew, like a lot of people, about the D-Day deception before D-Day, mm-hmm. but not about this one going on afterwards. And, you know, John, the more time I've spent on this, and that was 10 years ago, so I am growing old with the Ghost Army, the more fascinating it becomes, the more interesting connections to the world of art, the world of science, all over, come back to the Ghost Army.
Let's listen to another one of the sounds they would broadcast at night. Okay, I'm not sure what that is, what I'm supposed to be hearing. But well, if I were a German soldier, what would I think?
You might think that there's a lot of activity of some kind, and that particular sound is assembling pontoon bridges. So imagine that you are on one side of a river and you're hearing this coming from the other side. You might believe that the Americans are getting ready to put these pontoon bridges together that they're going to put across the river the next morning and be attacking there. So you're going to be bringing troops to that area.
So these things always happened at night.
Well, the sonic deception always happened at night because, obviously, if you can see at the same time, it's not going to work as well. But the visual and the radio might be happening in the daytime.
And was that actually the sound of a pontoon bridge being assembled somewhere, or was that somebody with sound effects clanking some things together?
No, they actually recorded these sounds for about 3 weeks at the Army Proving Ground in Fort Knox, Kentucky, in late 1943, early 1944, and brought them, they made their own sound effects records and brought them to Europe with them. And so they recorded those sounds.
So who were the soldiers of the Ghost Army back in real life?
Well, interestingly, a lot of the guys who handled the visual deception were artists.
They were artists.
Because, well, the Army recruited artists to handle some of the visual deception. Makes a lot of sense, right? People who are going to be creating a tableau that it's essentially a big trompe l'oeil painting that mm-hmm. we want to look good for the enemy. And some of these guys went on to become famous. Bill Blass, the fashion designer.
Was in the Ghost Army.
Was in the Ghost Army. Ellsworth Kelly, the famous minimalist artist. Mm-hmm. One of my favorites is Ed Haas, one of the creators of the Munsters. So you have artists.
Really? The creator of the Munsters was in the Ghost
Munsters,
Army.
In the Ghost Army. You have artists, you have designers, architects doing that, but you also have technical people to do the radio and the sound stuff, and you have regular GIs. One of the guys, I think it was Bill Blass actually, who said that there was kind of a culture clash inside the Ghost Army. On one end of the barracks, you'd hear Beethoven's Fifth, and on the other end, you'd hear Pistol Packin' Mama. And yet, it's a great American parable, right? Because these guys work together to create the deceptions that help save lives, that help win the war.
We're going to bring in Steve from Greenville, South Carolina. Steve, welcome to On Point.
Thanks. Enjoy the discussion. My question centers around D-Day. Was it the Ghost Army that was involved on the English side of the channel across from Calais, trying to sort of build a diversion right before D-Day, knowing we were going down to Omaha?
No, that's actually a different deception done by largely by the British. And the Ghost Army deceptions really start about a week after D-Day. And I actually led a tour there last September, and we're doing it again in September of 2016 through Stephen Ambrose Historical Tours. And we cover some of the places where these deceptions take place. And it's France, and it's Luxembourg, and it's Belgium, and it's Germany. So this is really happening on the ground while the battlefield is going on. They really weren't involved in the D-Day deception at all. It's interesting to me that the D-Day deception was declassified way before the Ghost Army was declassified. Don't know why, but interesting.
The fact that they were involved in deception, does that mean that they were not near combat?
No, they were near combat. And these guys were, I mean, they were all soldiers who'd gone through basic training, and they carried, you know, small arms, carbines or pistols with them. And they took casualties.
They did.
They had three men killed. 25 or 30 wounded pretty seriously over the course of carrying out these deceptions. And I, you know, I always say that there's a lot of funny stories involving deception with the Ghost Army, that we have to remember that men bled and died to carry out these missions, even though they're sort of strange and quirky.
Were you able to find evidence that they made a difference?
There are German records that show in several of the cases that that they bought the deception.
Really?
In some other cases and some other deceptions, there's not so much evidence. The very last deception they did was to basically make it appear that the 9th U.S. Army was crossing the Rhine River at one point where they were really crossing 10 miles away. And Army intelligence people believed that they may have saved thousands of lives with that one deception. And I literally have met World War II soldiers who hear about this and realize that they did a deception that helped their unit and say, wow, maybe my life was saved by the Ghost Army.
Let's bring in Annie from La Crosse, Wisconsin. Annie, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. Hey, I just wanted to mention, I saw the video, it's a documentary on public television about the Ghost Army. It totally drew me in and astounded me. And one of the things was is that these artists carried drawing materials with them, and whenever they had a second off, they drew all the destruction they saw. They drew dead soldiers, they drew what they were doing, and it, as an artist, it just blew me away. And thank you very much.
Does this art still exist? Well, obviously since Annie saw it.
Yes, we not only is it in the documentary, and she's very right, these artists were kind of cataloging what's going on, describing it. It's a lot of it is in the book that we have, The Ghost Army of World War II. I say that this is a World War II book with an art book embedded inside of it. Mm-hmm. And it's great because it's a very different perspective on World War II. You know, it's not battle footage. It's not black and white photos. It's the interpretations of these young artists as they're going through the war zone. And some of it's really moving work.
Are the men still around? I know Bill Blass passed away sometime back.
Of the 1,100 men who were in the unit, I think there's about 35 or 40 who are still with us. And that's, you know, unfortunately about average for people in the World War II generation.
And what did – for the many, many decades during which this was classified – in a classified operation, what did they tell their families they did in the war?
Yeah, blew up tanks and guns is one of the answers. You know, some of them told their families what they did. Others I talked to one soldier who was married for 40 years, never told his wife. She passed away before this was declassified. He never told her what she did.
Let's bring in Bob from Barton, Vermont. Bob, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John.
Hi.
I wanted to mention a book that was published a number of years ago called Bodyguard of Lies by Anthony Cave Brown that discusses basically the British part of the Ghost Army. And it seems to me one of the keys to the Ghost Army was the fact that the British had broken the German code and knew basically before Rommel, for example, knew what the Germans were going to do and could take preventive action. But The Bodyguard of Lies is a fantastic book, and I'm looking forward to reading this new book.
Thanks for your call. Do you know about Bodyguard of Lies?
Yes, and it's mostly, again, about the D-Day deception. But he's absolutely right that cracking the code, the Enigma code of the Germans, was something that really helped the Allies in all of the deceptions, because they could see, you know, whether it's working, or they could figure out what the enemy might want to do and therefore try to put the Ghost Army in a place that would counter that.
Let's bring in Greg from Racine, Wisconsin. Greg, welcome to On Point.
Thanks. Hi, John.
Hi.
I am really curious about the kind of equipment by which these sound recordings were played back, and trying to imagine how in the limited technology of that day they could possibly be fully convincing. Could you tell us how they were played back, on what kind of equipment, and how effective they were?
Sure. So, of course, they're recorded, as I mentioned, onto sound effects records, but then they mixed the sound for any scenario onto what's called a wire recorder, which is the predecessor of the tape recorder. And it was a new invention, basically, in the 1940s. And it's magnetized wire, about the size of a fishing line, very thin, and 2 miles of it on a reel holds about half an hour of sound. And so they would play it from these wire recorders over these very large speakers. And I have a wire recorder. It's great sound quality. It sounds perfect. The problem with it is that the wires can get tangled and it can have some problems. That's why the tape recorder was so much more effective. But the wire recorder is what they used, and it was state-of-the-art in 1945, forgotten about in 2015.
Is there a ghost army today somewhere out there?
You know, for some reason, the U.S. Army doesn't want to tell me about all of the deception things that they do. But we've talked about this. I've talked about this a lot with people in the intelligence community and in the Army. And what they say is, you know, the ideas of the Ghost Army are still valid, to try to find this multimedia ways to deceive enemy intelligence. But now you might be using Facebook. You might be using Twitter. Mm-hmm. Imagine that suddenly Twitter lights up with a bunch of folks at Camp Lejeune who are headed out to war. That's the new way you do deception in 2015.
Rick Beyer, co-author of the book The Ghost Army of World War II and documentary filmmaker of The Ghost Army. Rick Beyer, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, how the numbers work against women in the dating market and are changing the way we date. I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.